This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, the best and worst tech gifts for the holidays. But first, you'll be able to get a view of what's expected to be one of the best celestial shows of the year. The annual Geminid meteor shower peaks tonight and early tomorrow. And joining us to discuss how to learn about and enjoy meteor showers and the other wonders in the world above us is Cincinnati Observatory Assistant Director Dean Regas. Dean, who is also co-host of the PBS series Stargazers and co-host of the Cincinnati Public Radio podcast Looking Up, has just published his second book, 100 Things to See in the Night Sky, From Planets and Satellites to Meteors and Constellations, Your Guide to Stargazing. And if you have any stargazing questions, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dean, good afternoon.
Afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
And tell us about this meteor shower tonight. Why is this expected to be one of the best celestial events of the year?
Yeah, this is one I've been looking forward to for the year. It's called the Geminid Meteor Shower. It's named after the constellation from where the shooting stars will seem to radiate from, from Gemini. And it happens every year about December 13th and 14th. And what it is the Earth is passing through the remnants of an asteroid called 3200 Phaethon. And we hit this debris and acts like shooting stars going across the sky. And so the moon will be not very lit up, so it should be good viewing. If only we didn't have clouds.
Mm. Now, this is a little bit different from your typical meteor shower, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, most meteor showers like the Perseids and Leonids come from comets, so from comet tails. And this is one of the exceptions. This one's from this asteroid that's like kind of a rocky comet. And it's also this object, 3200 Phaethon, is going to go by the Earth on the 16th. Now, by the Earth in astronomical terms means 6 million miles, so it's going to miss us by quite a bit.
But, so nothing to worry about
nothing
here.
Nothing to worry about here, but it's going to leave some debris behind again, and it'll be a good position for us to do some observations. At least the professional telescopes will be able to check out this thing pretty closely.
So how's what's the best way to view this? Where are the best places to view something like this?
Yeah, well, the first part is the timing. You can't just go out at like 7 o'clock tonight. It's in the morning. Usually best time is midnight to 5 a.m., and so you do have to get up kind of early or stay up late. But what you do is you kind of early on, you face east and look for the constellation Gemini. You kick back in a lawn chair, get your hot chocolate, your coffee out there,
be
warm. And all you do is just take as much of the sky in as you can and watch for shooting stars. Now, the hype is that they could have up to 100 per hour, and I would say dial that back, please. It's 100 an hour is unlikely. Mostly, if you're in the city limits, maybe a dozen per hour, so maybe one every 5 minutes. But you might see one streaking across the sky, and then it might be 20 minutes before the next one, or you might see a few in a row.
So 100 per hour might be a little on the high side.
Well, very high, very
is
high.
Is it usually about a dozen?
Well, so the NASA always makes these predictions, and they're always best case scenarios. They're like, if you're in the desert and there's no light pollution, or you're on a sailing vessel in the middle Pacific. But really for normal folks in cities and even suburban areas, you're only going to see the brightest ones. And so typically it's about 10 to 20 an hour if you're lucky.
Now let's talk about your new book, Dean, 100 Things to See in the Night Sky, and this meteor shower is among the 100 things. What led you to write the book? What did you want to accomplish with this?
Yeah, I think the main idea was just to have a stargazing guide, a guide to the things that are out there that you can find with the naked eye. And it kind of goes along with how I learned astronomy in the first place. About 20 years ago, I started working at a planetarium, and I knew nothing. I didn't even know where the North Star was. And here I was expected to give planetarium shows to kids very quickly. And so I needed to pick what the best things to see were and what the easiest things to find and try to first teach myself and then from there show other people. And I know that learning astronomy can be really intimidating at first because there's so many things out there to look for. And this starts with the easy stuff and then works your way up to harder stuff and harder stuff. But once you get a foothold in it, then it becomes a little less scary to do stargazing.
What was that first show you did at the planetarium like?
Oh my gosh, I was so nervous. I mean, like here I was, I'd worked for the parks and I did nature hikes and I did, bird talks and fossil talks. But my first planetarium show, I thought, what am I doing? I'm pretending to be an astronomer. These kids know more than I do, I'm sure. And so I just was kind of relaxed and I did a lot of mythology. That was the part that kind of attracted me to it also. And so that's in the book as well. There's some mythology behind Orion and the Gemini twins and Taurus and some of the other things. And that always helped me bring the story home.
Now, do you know if kids get any education in astronomy and the stars in grade school or high school? Or is this something that virtually everyone just has to go out and learn on their own if they want to do this?
Mostly, you're right. Mostly it is they learn it on their own. Astronomy is taught very little in schools. It's usually around second grade. They do a little bit. Fifth grade, eighth grade, and then not a lot in high school unless they have electives. And so that's one of the things that we know that I know from experience that kids go in these stages. They go through their bug stage and dinosaur stage and shark stage and then star stage. They get really into astronomy. And so that's one thing that I wish we had more of that in school. But right now, I think it's people getting interested on their own. And there's lots of avenues for people to do that.
Did you take any formal classes, Dean, or did you just do this on the fly?
I'm completely self-taught. The planetarium taught me very quickly. I've never taken an astronomy class in my life. And it's one of those things that I just found a passion for. When I did that first show, it just something sparked in me. The stars started talking to me, and I thought, this is it. This is it. I'd had many other jobs before this, and many other positions, but this was what struck me. And I thought, I knew it right away. This is what I want to do the rest of my life.
How popular has stargazing become?
I think it's incredibly popular. I think people have this kind of secret ambition towards this, or secret mm-hmm. love of astronomy. And I think it's just more of taking the opportunity to take the time and sit out under the stars. And a couple of weeks ago, we had a supermoon event at the Cincinnati Observatory where we just were outside watching a moonrise, which is, happens pretty much every day that you can see. But it's just the people that came out that took the time. We had hundreds of people come out and they're just sitting outside in the semi-freezing cold in December and they're just watching the moonrise. And it can be as simple as that.
What's a supermoon, Dean?
Supermoon is when you have the largest full moon of the year, when it's closest to the Earth, because the moon changes its distance just a little bit. So the moon looks a little bit larger than average. And so that was on December 3rd where we had the supermoon. And so it's really hard to tell the difference between a supermoon and a normal moon. But there, I don't know. When I was out there, it was so incredibly bright and brilliant. And it's a good excuse to get people outside.
Now, if someone has never engaged in stargazing, what's a good point for them to start at? How do they begin doing this?
Yeah, I think that was one of the nicer additions I had in my book, The 100 Things to See in the Night Sky, is that I have it broken down also by difficulty level. So there's easy objects to find, there's moderate, and then there's difficult objects to find. And the easy ones start off about as easy as they get. The sun and the moon. Everybody knows what those are.
Okay.
But there's some hidden things.
And that's
things.
Encouraging because I can do that.
I know, exactly. I say you can read this book if you know one thing, where the sky is, up. So if you get that, then you're fine. But there are some kind of little things to look for with the sun and the moon. And first, observing the sun safely, there's tips on how to do that. Secondly, where the sun rises and sets is kind of neat to look at. And then the same with the moon. But then after you get past that, then you get to the next brightest object. So those are the planets. And if you can identify the planets in the sky, that is really a cool extra step because we've got Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn are all visible to the naked eye. And I kind of joke about this, but I'm kind of serious too, is that if you can go outside and take and show somebody Jupiter or show somebody Mars and you say, there is Jupiter right there, they will think you are the coolest person ever.
And Is that all it takes?
Try it out. It's impress your friends and family. It works.
So it sounds like what you're saying is start easy. Build your skills at stargazing. Build some confidence and learn to navigate your way around the sky a little bit to get into this.
Yeah, and it helps if you view from the same location every day too. I think that helps a lot. Then you notice where things are in reference to landmarks like trees and houses. And but yeah, there's so many really bright objects that are visible in cities that you can find the top 20 major stars are really cool to find. And so start easy. Start with things like the Big Dipper. Start with Orion's Belt, and you can use those stars to point at other things. And it begins to. I also say that if you do this for 5 nights in a row, it's going to click in your head. It's the five night stargazer challenge. That's what I usually issue. If you can do that, you'll start to make sense of stuff very quickly.
As far as gazing at the sun, you use the word safely. How do you do that safely? I guess, is it like with an eclipse?
Yes, it's same thing. Same rules apply for normal viewing of the sun as when you have a solar eclipse. You had to use those special solar eclipse glasses, or what I prefer that is that number 14 welder's glass, really, really dark welder's glasses. And so then you can look at the sun safely anytime you want. You put that in front of your eyes. You can stare at the sun all you want, but then you can invest in some kind of higher tech stuff where you can get filters for your telescopes, for your binoculars, but it can be done very nicely even on the cheap.
And I guess even making a pinhole camera would be a way to observe the sun.
Yeah, pinhole camera works pretty well. That works a lot better with eclipses because then you can see the actual shape, but pinhole cameras – on a normal sunny day might be a little boring for the average person just because you just see a little dot. And that usually doesn't make a picture big enough to see sunspots and that kind of stuff. But I like the number 14 welder's glass approach because it just makes it look really cool.
Mm-hmm. And I guess people should also be aware when you're looking at the sun, you're not going to see that great big ball, are you? It's going to be a lot smaller image in whatever you're viewing it through.
Oh, exactly. That's a big surprise to people is that they think the sun should be gigantic in the sky because it's so bright up there. But yeah, when you dim down the light, it's very small. The sun and moon appear like they're the same size in the sky from Earth. And so it is very small up in the sky, but you got to think that thing's 93 million miles away and still providing all this light and heat for us.
But with the naked eye, what can you see?
The naked eye, you can see the disk of the sun very clearly. But and then if there are big sunspots, you can see a sunspot with the naked eye. That happens maybe about once out of every 2 months or so. You can see a sunspot that big. And so if you can see that, that means that spot is the size of the Earth, if you can make it out with the naked eye.
And if you use a telescope with a filter, what kinds of things can you see?
Then you can see a lot more detail. You see a lot more of the smaller sunspots. And then with a special filter called a hydrogen alpha filter, you can see eruptions on the side of the sun called prominences. And that'll set you back $600 to $10,000, depending on which one you get. Whereas the welder's glass, $5. I like the $5 view. Of course, the $10,000 view is pretty good too.
We will continue our conversation with Dean Regas, and you can join us at 513-419-7100 if you have any stargazing questions. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Cincinnati Observatory Assistant Director Dean Regas joins us this afternoon. Dean, who's also the co-host of the PBS series Stargazers and co-host of the Cincinnati Public Radio podcast Looking Up, has just published a second book. It's called 100 Things to See in the Night Sky, From Planets and Satellites to Meteors and Constellations, Your Guide to Stargazing. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So you start off with the sun and the moon, you advance out to these planets that are more visible, and then you move off to what? Constellations comes next?
Yep, stars and constellations comes next. And that's the bulk of the book, actually, is covering the best constellations and biggest, brightest stars to see in the nighttime sky. So the first section talks about everything in the northern sky, like the Big Dipper, Little Dipper, Cassiopeia, things that are visible almost all year. And then we get into by season. We break it down by season. So winter sky, we have Orion and Gemini up there. And then the spring, summer, and fall, each season has its own group of constellations to look for.
Is there one season that's any better than the others? Or?
Well, in the Midwest, definitely the fall is the best viewing condition. So August, September, October, we have low humidity, clear skies, great views. Unfortunately, the fall constellations are not too stellar, I would say. We've got Pegasus the Flying Horse, which is pretty good. Perseus is up there, Andromeda's up there, but they are not quite as bright and dynamic as the winter sky that we have coming up with Orion, Sirius, the dog star, which people are going to start to notice rising in the southeast soon. It's Sirius season. We're going to be getting calls at the observatory saying, what's that really bright star in the southeast? Because it twinkles red, white, and blue. Very interesting star. So the winter sky has the most bright stars, and that's a perfect place to get started because Orion can show you where a whole bunch of stuff is.
And speaking of stars, I wanted to ask you, do you get a lot of questions this time of year about the Star of Bethlehem?
We do, yes. It's one of those things that that people ask when they come to the observatory, especially around December. They want to think, okay, well, I don't know a lot about astronomy, but what do I know? Oh, religion. Okay. Oh, I wonder if he knows what the Star of Bethlehem was. I mean, this is the star that signaled the birth of Jesus, and it's on all postcards and Christmas cards. And so what was it? And this is a question that, at first I didn't really want to answer because I thought, well, this is beyond the scope of an astronomer. I don't know. And when I'd answer, I'm not sure, maybe who knows what it was. People didn't like that answer. So I thought, well, I better dig into this and find out what this is. I went through all the scenarios that could this have been a comet? Could this have been a supernova? Could this have been a shooting star or something like that? And it just didn't match up. The description of the Bible did not match any possible thing. So I ruled out everything. I ruled out planetary conjunction.
What's a conjunction? Is that when
two planets come together? So if you had Venus and Jupiter, two very bright planets, they come together. Can they get close enough to appear as one bright star? And there really wasn't anything that looked good enough to do that. And so I ruled them all out. But still, I need to come up an answer to somebody. And so when people ask me, I say, well, it's not this, it's not that, it's not that. There's only one possible scenario, only one possible answer. That was a UFO.
A UFO?
A UFO.
As in flying saucer?
No, unidentified okay. flying object. We don't know what it was.
Okay.
Probably not an alien, but it doesn't match any known astronomical event. And so, I say this kind of jokingly, but I think that's the real answer is that this shouldn't be a normal event. This is, if I said, oh, it's just a planetary conjunction, happens every 12 years, that's not a big deal. Let's make it something really special, one-time event that never was repeated ever again, and even astronomers don't know what it is. And I think that's how it should be.
Yeah, so there's no consensus on what this was, and there are a number of different camps on what this might have been.
Oh, yeah, and I do get a little the part that gets me riled up is when astronomers weigh in on this and they give wrong answers when they say, oh, yeah, it was a planetary conjunction, and I get kind of offended. I'm like, what? There's no way they can mistake a planetary conjunction.
So the stargazers back then were, the astronomers back then were savvy enough to know the difference.
They would have known. I mean, it's so easy. I mean, to find the planets in the sky are so easy. They would have known it was Venus and Jupiter together. Come on. Sorry, I'm getting worked up, Mark.
We'll have to move on to something else, Dean.
I'm not worked up about my religious fervor. It's my scientific fervor. That's what it is.
513-419-7100, and Percy joins us. Hi, Percy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I do hope to buy your book here soon, but my question is, if I were, say, in Germany, which I hope to be there next year, if I was in Germany, would the same rules apply as far as me looking for certain planets?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because the way it works is that whatever your latitude is, that kind of tells you what you're going to see. So everybody, here we're in 39 degrees latitude. And the book that I wrote here, this one's good for the mid-latitude. So from about 25 degrees to 55 degrees. That includes most of Europe and North Africa and most of Asia, too. So this book is good for all those places in the Northern Hemisphere. And I'm currently working on a Southern Hemisphere version, too. So it'll be good for Australia, South Africa, and Patagonia. When you're in Germany, you're seeing about the same stars that we're seeing here.
513-419-7100. Let's talk to Gary. Hi, Gary.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Question for Dean. Dean, I had a chance to vacation up in Eagle Harbor, Michigan, up in the Keweenaw Peninsula, and we were shocked at how the how many stars we could see when we were up there at night. And I'm just wondering where you've been on Earth where you have had the clearest view of the night sky, and where closest to us here would have the best view of the night sky.
Oh, yeah, that's really important. To get away from the city lights and see the sky like it was meant to be, that's the best. I've had some really good experiences on the Big Island of Hawaii. I got to see some great views. Peru, I was down in Peru and saw some, just the southern sky there was incredible with the Southern Cross. And then, you know, closer to northern Arizona, northern New Mexico are great spots. But I think you just picked one, Michigan, Upper Peninsula, Michigan, dark skies, not terribly far a drive. That's where I would go. Of course, the problem is it gets a little cloudier there. Getting the nice desert air in Arizona and Tucson might be a little better. But yeah, that's wherever you can go. Our members go out to Stone Lick State Park. That's the park out east of Cincinnati. On two Saturdays a month. In fact, they're going to be out there this Saturday. It's a free stargaze. You can go out there. If it's clear, they'll be there, and they start right after dark. That's a great place to go.
Dean, how did that? I've always wondered, how were the constellations discovered? I mean, how do people put these patterns together and say that's the Dipper, that's the Bear, that's Orion? How did that occur? And who named these?
Well, yeah, it's hard to tell exactly who started this off, but I think it must have been just kind of part of human nature. They're kicking back after a long day of working, and they look up and they take in these stars. And the only thing I can relate it to is that when they watch the stars, the ancients all across the world, they watch the stars the same way we watch TV. That was their form of entertainment. They kicked back and they looked at those stars, and somebody probably said, you know, those stars look like a giant hunter. Or those stars look like Bob down the street. Or, you know, they would start making stories.
Sounds almost like they're looking at clouds. It looks like a bunny. It looks like a dog.
Very much so. Okay. And so then if you could tell a story behind that, and those were passed down from generation to generation, the best stories always made the most impression. Most of the constellations I touch in are Greek in origin. They go back about 2,500 years. But some of them were borrowed from people before them, like Babylonians, that go back even another 1,000 years.
So what's the easiest constellation to pick up on?
I think Orion is definitely the easiest one, especially this time of year, because you have three stars in a row for a belt. And you just see those three stars, and that's really a landmark in the sky. And then he's got his legs, his brighter stars, Rigel and Betelgeuse. And of course, if you find Betelgeuse, then you got to say Betelgeuse. Did I say it three times? I don't know, but that's a good star to look for. And then I think we also have another really bright star called Capella that's out in the northeastern sky that is really dazzling bright too to check out. That one's good to see.
What's the most challenging to see?
Oh yeah, there's a few difficult ones I put in the book, and probably the one that's the most questionable, I put the Andromeda Galaxy in there. That's one you can see with the naked eye if you're in a dark sky. So that's the farthest thing you could see with the naked eye, about 2.5 million light years. But the one that probably was the one that snuck in, I kind of wasn't sure about, I put the Hercules Cluster. I wanted all these objects to be visible with the naked eye. The Hercules Cluster is probably the only one that, I don't know. I think I've seen it with the naked eye, but maybe I squint pretty good. I don't know. But it's a cluster of about 1 million stars in one place in the constellation of Hercules. It looks awesome in a telescope. If you look up a picture for M13, Hercules cluster, it's awesome in a telescope. Barely visible to the naked eye, but when you find it, oh man, you got it. It's cool.
What's your favorite thing to look at in the night sky?
I definitely like planets, but, you know, I guess I'm nerdy enough that I have favorite stars. My favorite star in the whole galaxy is called Bellatrix. It's this bluish purple star in the shoulder of Orion. And the color, blue's my favorite color, and that star just twinkles. I just love looking at it.
Chuck joins us now. Hi, Chuck.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Go right ahead.
Yes, I'd just like to make the point that talking about the stars, the skies rather, back when the ancient peoples were looking at them, and even a couple of hundred years ago or 100 years ago, the skies were so much clearer, just orders of magnitude clearer as far as light pollution and development.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really hard for us to compare today's skies to the skies back then. I mean, you get glimpses of it if you get in the middle of nowhere. But still, that I think it also leads people to think, okay, well, wait, how did they picture a queen up there in Cassiopeia? It looks like just an M of stars. And I wonder if it was so much darker that they saw so many stars, or if in fact they were just really, really bored. I don't know, but they're trying to connect the dots and make all these pictures up there. And to me, that's our connection to our ancestors, is this is what they were doing. That was their pastime, and we see the same stars that they saw.
And since we're looking at old light, Dean, billions of years away, do we know of anything we see now that maybe blinked out a long time ago?
Well, yeah. That's the other thing, is when you're looking at space, you're looking back in time also. It takes time for the light to travel from the object to your eyes. And so for things like the planets and the sun, we're just talking that light is just minutes old or hours old. But if we're looking at stars, that starlight left that star years ago or hundreds of years ago. And in the case of the Andromeda Galaxy, 2.5 million years ago. So
wow.
When you're looking at the starlight, that's the star. That's where the star was back then. And that's one of the other cooler things, is you're a time traveler when you're looking at the sky.
Let's talk to Phil. Hi, Phil.
Hi guys. Dean, I have a question for you. First of all, I just recently bought a telescope, and so I'm really grateful to have astronomers like you and to have this radio show to give me more information. So thank you.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I've been looking at this star. I don't know how to pronounce it. It may be Albireo or
Albireo.
Albireo. It's beautiful. In the telescope, one star looks blue and the one right next to it looks gold.
Yep.
Are there any other stars like that I could search in the winter sky?
Well, you found definitely the highlight. This is the Albireo, is its name.
And he's talking about a double star?
It's a double star. So to the naked eye, it looks like one star. It's the head of Cygnus the Swan. Very easy to identify at this time of year, too. And so Cygnus the Swan's head star, yeah, when you look at it with a telescope, it breaks into two. There's one big orange star and a little blue star there, and they make a nice contrasting colors. Another one I'd put on there would be Algeba. It's a star in Leo. I think these are all in my book, actually. But anyway, I think Algeba's in there. There's one that's not in my book that I'd probably look for if you have a telescope. It's called Sigma Orionis. It's near Orion's belt. It's a nice little group of stars you can find pretty nicely with the telescope.
So your latest podcasting, talking about telescopes, you give some gift ideas for telescopes for the holidays.
Oh, yeah. It's that time of year, that's for sure. And folks are interested in getting telescopes for friends, family, that kind of thing. It's one of those things you definitely should shop around, and you shouldn't do it very quickly. And you do have to invest some money. That's my one rule of thumb, is there's no such thing as a $100 good telescope.
So you get what you pay for with telescopes?
Yeah, usually you do. So I recommend getting the most bang you can get from the buck, the biggest telescope you can get, the biggest mirror or biggest lens. And so those are usually called reflector telescopes with a Dobsonian mount on it. So Dobsonian reflectors usually give you the biggest bang for the buck.
Dean, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks. Keep looking up, guys.
Cincinnati Observatory Assistant Director Dean Regas, his latest book is 100 Things to See in the Night Sky, and his first book is Facts from Space. We have to point that out, Dean. And he'll be one of the featured speakers this evening at Cincy Storytellers Holiday Spectacular from 7 to 8:30 at the Phoenix downtown. You can find a link to more information at wvxu.org.